This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio today by editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning to talk through some of the stories on their website that they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, we've a property special from grand designs to a place in the sun. Is this the last hurrah for buy-to-let as mortgage lending skyrockets almost 60%? Nightmare new builds, and is Brexit going to collapse our dreams of that chateau in Champagne?
If we do choose to opt out, I don't think the whole of Europe's suddenly going to say, right, I'm sorry, you're a Brit, you can't buy in this country.
Also today, we focus on fraud, with one we're particularly being warned to be on the lookout for at the moment, cash machines. But how can you spot when one's been tampered with?
There may well be people out there who have had these problems, thought they were a bit silly, and just don't want to talk about it. But the amount of money they've lost all adds up. So contact your bank immediately.
We return to the car emissions scandal, Mitsubishi in the firing line, as VW aims to draw a line under the whole sorry issue.
The more manufacturers that are embroiled in this, you do have to question whether it is an industry-wide scandal.
Sticking with cars, as Peugeot 205 GTI sells for a record $25,000 at auction, we ask how the hot hatch became such hot property, and Highway to Hell. Some rather disgruntled This Is Money readers have emailed in and taken to Twitter to complain that AC/DC have replaced Brian Johnson with Guns N' Roses singer Axl Rose for their forthcoming UK tour, asking, can I get a refund? So I want to know, because we like to be positive here, a time when you were pleasantly pleased with an unexpected change of plan. A very good morning to you, Simon. A very good morning to you, Rich. Welcome to the studio. Simon, to you first, a time when you were pleasantly pleased with an unexpected change of plan.
Right. Well, on the spot, I can't think of anything, but I'll tell you a Guns N' Roses related story with an unexpected change of plan. There you go.
You queued me up nicely. I emailed you earlier to let you know what the question might be, and you're still with 45 minutes.
Sorry,
so you've got an Axl Rose story.
So, Axl Rose is famous for basically not going on stage on time. It was actually one of the things that was involved in breaking the band up. Now, Axl Rose toured with his version of Guns N' Roses, which was basically like a Guns N' Roses tribute act with Axl singing. Probably the best Guns N' Roses tribute act you'll see, but it wasn't the real thing. I saw them going back, must be 9-10 years ago now, and we saw them in Hammersmith. And we got there, and Axl and the band were meant to go on stage at about 9. He went on stage at about midnight, basically. There was quite a few disgruntled people in the audience standing there complaining, people going because they had to go get trains home. Fortunately, we lived in London, so it wasn't so much of an issue for us, so we waited until 12. But it did mean that we got to spend 3 hours in the bar. So the unexpected change of plans, whereby we expected to see Axl and his band at 9, and we actually saw them at 12, and then he played for 2.5 hours, I should say, so it didn't finish till gone 2 in the morning, actually turned out to be a brilliant evening, because by the time he came on stage, we were having a pretty good time.
You probably thought he was Brian Johnson anyway. It would make no difference. And maybe that's the plan. But you're not helping the situation, though, Simon, if people are going to email into This Is Money, you are big Brian Johnson fans.
Apparently, he has massively improved on this. So Guns N' Roses have got back together with some of the original members of the band, and he has been arriving on stage within about 10 minutes of when they're meant to be on, which is a real turn up for the book. So good news, AC/DC fans. You may not have to wait until gone midnight to see the band.
Rich, I'm going to turn to you and ask you, well, I was going to ask you the same question, or any Axl Rose sort of stories tell us.
I haven't got an Axl Rose. I would say, though, I was a theatre critic back in the day, and the stand-ins were always better than the main act. So there you go, AC/DC fans, it's going to be a great night. But my unexpected pleasure, I worked on campsites when I finished university, and I was coming back to get the ferry after the contract finished, and I thought, hang on a minute, I'm not going to get the ferry, I'm going to get the train. And I got on the train down to Naples, where some of my friends were living, and went and outstayed my welcome there for about 2 or 3 months, and ended up learning Italian and having the best time of my life.
That is excellent. I'm going to stick to one music-related story before we move on, Simon, because I saw a tweet from you yesterday relating to Prince. You're a big fan.
Oh, yeah, I think we should dedicate this show to Prince. Prince was a hero of mine. I thought Prince was an amazing musician and a hugely talented man, and I've loved him since I was a little kid. I remember dancing around my parents' lounge when I was about 9, watching the Love Sexy tour on TV. It was on Channel 4. Channel 4 broadcast it. I can actually vividly remember this. And probably the last time I danced to Prince was around my own lounge with my own kids now. So I think that's nice. I saw him live. He was absolutely brilliant at the O2. And what I was saying to Rich before we came in here was the thing I loved about Prince was that it was really about the music. And he did this thing where he turned around to the record industry and said, I don't really want to do what you want to do. I'm going to do my own thing. And they turned around to him and said, well, look, you've got to fit the plan. You've got to release an album every 2 years, then you've got to tour it, then you release an album another 2 years. And Prince said, I just want to make music and I just want to release all my music. And that's where that whole symbol, slave, the artist formerly known as Prince thing came along. And the record industry turned around to him and said, we can make you the biggest star in the world. We can make you the richest pop musician who's ever lived. Because bear in mind, Prince, coming off the back of Diamonds and Pearls, was huge. And not only was he huge, he wrote all his own songs, he played all the instruments, he had that talent. And he just said, no, I don't want to do that, I want to do it. And he did all the secret gigs, the, you know, the releasing loads of songs, and he was still making great music right up until he died. So, Prince, thanks very much.
Here's our reporter, Barry Weir.
From singing at a New York theatre to outside Prince's Minnesota home.
His music is... been there for me since 1979.
People are paying tribute. Tests will be carried out later to establish how he died, but for now, fans are remembering the music. He sold over 100 million records, won an Oscar, and wrote number one hits for many other artists. The US president says the world's lost a creative icon.
Kiss. On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You are listening to Share Radio. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning in partnership with NS9. Coming up, celeb regrets, cashpoint scams, and would you buy a new built home? But first, is this the last hurrah for buy-to-let? Blamed on landlords and second home buyers rushing to beat the April change in stamp duty, mortgage lending skyrocketed almost 60% in March. That works out at £25.7 billion dished out last month, 43% more than in February. So why the rush? Here's Share Radio's Ed Bowsher.
Investors were trying to avoid this big rise in stamp duty that only applies to buy-to-let properties, second homes and holiday homes. And they're increasing stamp duty by 3%, which doesn't sound much, but the way it's being applied can work out as very substantial because it's being applied to all of the value of the property. So, for example, a £300,000 home, if you bought it under the old rules, you'd be paying £5,000 stamp duty. If you buy it under the new rules that have just come in, it's an extra £9,000, so you're paying £14,000 in stamp duty if you're a buy-to-let landlord or someone buying a second home. So obviously that's a massive increase in costs for the landlord.
Well, it is indeed. Changes not to be sniffed at on a £250,000 home. The new stamp duty bill would be £12,000 compared to £3,750 previously. We're also hearing house prices in cities such as Liverpool, Cardiff and Southampton have increased to a 12-year high. Now, Alice Martin is a housing economist at the New Economics Foundation. I asked her whether she thought this stamp duty and other measures would help the housing crisis.
I think people are sceptical as to if they'll make any difference whatsoever in the long term, because you can still turn a massive profit from owning a second home and renting it out, both from the rental income, particularly if you live somewhere like London, if your house is somewhere like London, but also because there's an expectation that house prices will rise in the way that they have been doing. Tinkering around the edges with changes to stamp duty won't really have a big impact on the amount of money flooding into property.
So then what will?
I think we need some more deep-rooted changes. I think we need to look at creating a kind of more diverse supply of housing stock, not just putting all of our eggs in the home ownership basket and trying to subsidise home ownership in the way that it's failing. So the government needs to reverse the kind of activities that it's been doing. It's withdrawal from providing public non-profit housing, because we need other forms there to kind of underpin this overheated market. But also we need to be looking at the banks and at, you know, the makeup of our financial system and really ask ourselves, do we want this kind of monolithic banking sector that is driven towards pouring money into property at the expense of small and medium-sized businesses?
So, Simon, you've been looking at this. Is this the last hurrah for buy-to-let? Why do you ask that question?
Well, maybe it is, because the Council of Mortgage Lenders said this is the biggest stamp duty distortion of the property market that they've ever registered, which is quite sizable. And these figures that were out yesterday only reflect gross mortgage lending, so they don't go down into the granular detail. So we don't know actually what all that money went on. But all of the signs point to this being to do with this big buy-to-let rush, which is interesting, to be honest, because there was a big question as to whether this was really occurring or would really occur. There was the suggestion that it was from a lot of state agents and people in the property industry. And then there was the suggestion from some other people that that was just the property industry selling its own book, drumming up business, trying to get people to rush in to buy homes and get people to pay higher prices. But actually, the evidence does seem to bear it out. And if you think about there being this huge rush into buying properties, and actually what's interesting is that it wasn't just last month, it was the whole 3 months of the year, so January, February, March, 39% higher than the same period in 2015. If you've seen all of that money pulled forward that would have otherwise gone into properties during the rest of the year, then what's going to happen now? Are we going to see a tipping point, a turning point? And have these people who've rushed in to buy these buy-to-lets overpaid, perhaps, in this rush? I know certainly from some mortgage brokers that I've spoken to, they said that they were working round the clock on the 31st of March, to get these sales through by the 1st of April. So the big question is, what happens now? I mean, some people, agents, are saying, well, we've got loads of demand from home movers and first-time buyers, and a lot of first-time buyer demand in particular, and that's going to keep things afloat. But 4 or 5 months down the line, will we see the property market come off the boil?
Well, Mohammed Jamai, you've been speaking to, CML economist, says as a result of what you've just been talking about, we expect there'll be about 10,000 fewer mortgage transactions each month in the second quarter of 2016 than would otherwise have been the case, offsetting the increase in activity seen in March. Jeremy Lee from RICS predicts the housing market will be less frenetic over the next few months, similarly to that, but more competitively priced, he says, offering opportunities for first-time buyers and those moving. Do you share those sentiments?
Yes, I think so. Probably if you're a first-time buyer, you're in a better position to be looking for a home and trying to buy a home in the coming months than you were in the months since George Osborne announced this. George Osborne announced this in the autumn statement in November, and then we saw this January, February, March rush. And just to put this into a little bit of context, basically gross mortgage lending was £9 billion more in March than it was a year earlier, which works out as £306 million a day in mortgages. Wow. That's an astonishing sum of money, isn't it? A huge sum. So maybe that being pulled out of the market will make things better for home movers and first-time buyers, because realistically, those people don't want prices to be rising really quickly.
Rich, I'm going to bring you in. We spoke about the immediate few months. What do you think the longer-term impact of all this activity on the housing market more generally is going to be?
I think one of the things I've taken from this story is the fact that it's very serious business people that are taking out these mortgages and getting involved in the buy-to-let. So for the longer term, I mean, like Simon says, they've done the business deals already. So the impact, you're asking me to predict the future of the housing market, I'm not going to do that. I will question whether we are at peak house prices. I've probably said that before, but I'll go with that again.
We've been speaking about, I mean, is this the last hurrah for buy-to-let, getting in before the stamp duty changes? But is the reality not going to be, Simon, that, well, it's still going to be seen as a relatively good investment and they're just going to bump up rental prices?
Yes, and that is certainly true. And there's also been this comment made that, for example, you add an extra 3% stamp duty. Well, if house prices rise by 3%, you've made it back. Are house prices going up at the moment? Yes, they're going up, you know, probably around 5% a year. So anybody who buys a property with this new 3% stamp duty, if house prices continue on the same trajectory, they go up by 5% over the next year, you've made your stamp duty back. But I think it is a significant barrier to entry, because the biggest issue that most people have when they're buying a property is raising a deposit. And if you buy a buy-to-let, you need to put down, broadly speaking, at least a 25% deposit. Now, even for the people buying buy-to-lets, that is a large sum of money. And not everyone has that kind of sum of money to put down. If you've got to pay out 3% of the purchase price in stamp duty, that eats into that deposit quite substantially. Then that has an effect on how much money someone will lend you on a mortgage, and so on and so on. Now, the response to this that you could see from banks and building societies is to simply loosen their lending criteria to make it a bit easier for people to take out buy-to-let mortgages. However, the Bank of England is also on the warpath over buy-to-let, and it's trying to stop banks and building societies doing that, because I think what it's worried about is that very thing, is this sort of, at the moment, actually standards are quite high, but I think it's worried about this loosening of standards as we move along the housing cycle. And the housing market tends to be one of those things that has bubbles in it. And if we move towards that bubble phase and those lending standards start loosening, that's when house prices keep rising, rising, rising. Then you get to the top and you get the roller coaster back down.
Before we move on from buy to let, I want you to look into your crystal ball again. Any more changes, do you think, on the buy to let horizon? Or can landlords perhaps breathe a little bit easier at the moment?
I can't see any more changes coming along. I think that there's been quite a big squeeze put on. The change that is coming up is the change to mortgage interest. So previously you could claim back all of your mortgage interest against rental income and then pay income tax on the difference, which is effectively your profit. Now you can't do that, and it's going to be limited to 20% rather than whatever your tax rate is. And many landlords will be 40% taxpayers. So that's going to put a big dent, especially in those landlords who are barely breaking even. And I think there's probably now a lot of landlords asking themselves the question, my property's gone up by, you know, X number of tens of thousands of pounds, perhaps by £100,000. You know, I've owned it for 5-10 years. Should I sell it? Should I cash in my gains? But what they have to balance against that is, what on earth do I do with the money after I've done that? Because you're not going to get much of a return in the savings account. And realistically, the reason why people say they like to invest in property is because they worry about the volatility of the stock market.
Another potentially big change, though, on the horizon for the housing market, it is, of course, the EU referendum on the 23rd. Here's Gwanyeh Gilmore, head of Knight Frank UK Residential Research.
Well, we're entering a bit of an uncertain phase in the overall economy. The EU referendum is still making headlines. But we also have, underpinning that, while you might have a more uncertain economic outlook over the short term, we still have sound economic fundamentals. We still have the supply and demand imbalance across the whole market, across the whole of the UK. Not only are the number of homes coming on for sale, second-hand homes, at record lows, we also have this drive to build more homes because we're just not building enough. So you have a lack of supply, whereas you still have strong demand in the market. So that is underpinning the market. But in the short term, there is a bit of uncertainty around the EU referendum and people not quite sure what's going to happen as a result. So they may be choosing to just wait and see, and that's having an impact on the market. But I think the property market can deal with change. It has dealt with so many changes in stamp duty, and over time, you can see those changes being absorbed and people making decisions to take those into account. But what the market struggles with is uncertainty. So even just having a decision at the other side, you could see an effect on the market.
Well, that was Gwanyeh Gilmore there speaking to Share Radio. Simon, is Brexit fears and the like already impacting the housing market?
I'm not so sure. It might impact some people buying in central London, for example, if they're, you know, they're Europeans. But then, realistically, it's not going to be a situation, if we leave the EU, that foreigners weren't going to be able to own homes here anyway. And I don't think that for your average first-time buyer or person considering moving home, Brexit is even on the scorecard of things that they are thinking about. I think they're worrying about whether they can raise enough money to buy that new home and worried about that price of the new home going up quicker than they can afford to get it.
I'm sure, but I imagine though property experts, economists and the like, politicians are talking about this quite extensively. What are the thoughts from those sorts of people about staying or leaving with regard to the housing market?
Well, they keep, with the housing market, they keep saying this sort of uncertainty thing and nobody knows what's going to happen. Is it going to be bad for the economy, bad for jobs? And I think that where you will see a reflection of that in the property market is that it does affect sentiment. If you're sat there as a home buyer or a potential home mover, or you're sat there thinking, well, should we move home this year? And you hear all of this chatter going on around you about, oh, things are bad, things are uncertain, things look gloomy, we don't know what's going to happen. You might be a bit more cautious and you might think, well, maybe I'm not gonna move. And it also makes banks more cautious. And let us not forget that banks and building societies are the crucial part in the bulk of home purchases, because they're the people that lend us the money so that we can buy them.
Well, you spoke, Simon, about people buying property here. What about those thinking of buying a home in Europe? Well, earlier I got the thoughts of Channel 4's Place in the Sun presenter Amanda Lamb and Liz Tomlinson, a property writer and journalist. Here's Amanda first.
Even if, and it's a very big if we do choose to opt out, I don't think the whole of Europe's suddenly going to say, right, I'm sorry, you're a Brit, you can't buy in this country anymore. You know, places like France and Spain get an enormous amount of money from us buying properties in their country. So I doubt very much that they will make it harder for us to buy somewhere like that. The only thing I can think that it will affect is the actual buying process. It might take longer. It might be a more lengthy process. You might have to spend slightly more on legal fees because you're not a member of the EU anymore. But having said that, you know, that Americans buy in Europe. You can buy in Europe if you are a non-EU member. I think probably it would just take a little bit more time.
If you live there full time, it will affect things like your rights to maybe it might be slightly more complicated for transferring pensions, things like that, your rights in the UK. You might pay slightly more capital gains tax on when you sell a property. I mean, taxation might be slightly higher. And obviously it will be slightly more complicated to get residency and move around.
I think there's an element of scaremongering going on at the moment. Everybody, well, say everybody, not everybody, you know, 90% of people don't know how it's going to affect them. And I'm surprised that figure isn't higher. I'm surprised it's not 100% because none of us know how it's going to affect us. I own a property in Italy, which I'm keeping and I'm renting out. And at the moment, I'm not in a state of panic. Like I say, I just think if we opt out, there will probably be more paperwork. It will be slightly more complicated to buy or to sell because we won't be a member of the EU. But that's probably as much as I can think will be a problem.
Well, that was Place in the Sun presenter Amanda Lamb there saying, don't panic. Something you'd agree with there, Rich?
I think today is probably the game changer in the whole Brexit thing, with Obama coming over and laying down the law from the top of the ruler of the free world. And I think people will start to think about it a lot more. And when people start to think about it, I think they will perhaps not panic, but they will look at the Brexit and think, hang on a minute, the economics here are quite sketchy. And that will, I think, affect sentiment. I think it probably has already in London, with some of these sort of new build places that are going up and nobody wants or can afford them. And if there's foreign buyers in there, then I think it's a problem that starts today.
Obama, a game changer?
He's kind of got every right to be, hasn't he? He does run the West.
Well, interestingly, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who's campaigning for us to leave, plus plenty of other EU out campaigners, pretty unhappy with Mr. Obama, calling him hypocritical.
It is a fact that America guards its sovereignty with such hysterical jealousy that American diplomats in this city still refuse to pay the congestion charge.
Simon, your views on that?
Well done, Boris, for getting that dig in there about the congestion charge. That is a really long-running row, that one. And actually pretty scandalous, to be honest. I think that the US could pick up its tab for the congestion charge. So, Obama, if you're listening, could you please settle that while you're over here? But I read something this week, and I can't remember who wrote it, and it was quite interesting. So I'm very undecided on this whole EU vote thing. I can definitely see both sides of the argument. And what I read said, basically, people must look at Britain and think that we're mad. We're in the EU, yet, realistically, we don't actually have to abide by a lot of the stuff that the EU comes out with. We're not in the Eurozone as well, which is a good thing. Yet we get to influence the decisions of effectively one of the largest and most influential political entities in the world. Yet we've decided that we want to leave so that we can just go do our own thing. And the suggestion was that really we can very much kind of do our own thing. And a lot of the stuff that we say that we could ditch, we probably wouldn't ditch anyway. Then we'd have this whole trade situation. You know, what sort of trading partner do we end up as? I think we're going to end up as Albania this week, which was quite interesting. Mm. But then also, on the other side of the coin, I think there's this thing where I think the EU is a terrible political entity. And I think a lot of people want out of it because they think it is very, very badly run and very, very unaccountable to the people who live in Europe. And I'm not just saying that for people who live in Britain, but I would say people who live in Britain, France, Germany, you know, Greece and so on. So I think that's what the argument comes down to.
I'm wondering if the cat's already out of the bag on this one, though, whether we stay in or out. Has it started to unravel?
Possibly, yeah, just the very prospect of it. And then there's this talk of, well, if we did leave, we wouldn't get a favourable deal because the EU would seek to hold us up as an example because it wouldn't want other countries to leave as well. I would say with the Obama thing, though, there's Obama coming over here and telling everyone to vote to stay in the EU is exactly the kind of thing that gets people in Britain to vote to leave the EU.
Well, that's what I was wondering
yeah.
as well.
Tell a we do tend to be quite a contrary nation and we don't respond very well to being told what to do.
One final thing, and I promise I won't go too much because we've got plenty of time to talk about this vote up until the 23rd. But Richard, am I right in thinking you've got a place in France? Are you certainly a Francophile?
I've got family over there.
Worried about this at all for you personally?
I'd be worried if suddenly my wife has to leave me and go back to live in France.
That's fair enough. Yeah, I'd be worried about that too. What are they saying in France as well? What's the atmosphere about it?
Oh, gosh. The French have always sort of taken the view that they're just quite amused by Britain. They don't really get it. I mean, they're very in favour of your whole Europe. Mm. And why not? You know, it's a massive global economy. It's you either believe in globalisation or you want to turn back the clock 50 years.
And the thing I would add is actually, so the French and the Germans are the ones who are hugely committed to this great European project. The reason why I think that there would be this element of potential punishment in terms of a Brexit if we did vote to leave is because the French and the Germans particularly that are holding Europe together really, really, really don't want Italy to leave. And Italy is the one country that might have a hell of a lot to gain by leaving the EU and particularly leaving the Eurozone.
Explain
and
why.
Italy has this history of sort of boom and bust and currency devaluation, and ever since it joined the Eurozone, it has not been able to do that currency devaluation. And there is an argument in Italy that it has stagnated ever since the Euro was brought in. And there's a lot of people in Italy who are upset at the way the country's gone, upset at the way the country's stagnated. And there's starting to be quite a big backlash in Italy against the EU and particularly against the Eurozone, but against the EU as well. And I think that that is the place. And you saw a big political protest movement there against Berlusconi and with Beppe Grillo and the Four Star Party and things like that. And I think that's the place that probably the French and the Germans worry about the most. I think they could live with Britain leaving the EU. I don't think they're really necessarily that bothered about that. But I think it's Italy they really worry about.
Well, we're going to put Brexit to bed. I think we've covered that about buying homes in Europe and the like. But from one TV property show that we've been talking about to another, perhaps A Place in the Sun is not for you, but what about a grand design in the UK?
I'm never ever going to do this again, I've decided. It's just not worth it. It really isn't. It's not worth the anxiety. It's not worth the time it's taking me away from my children. It's just, I can't see it's worth it. It can never be worth it. It's only a thing at the end of the day. It's just a house. It's just bricks.
I'm sure that particular home builder is not alone. So you've been looking at the fact that there are three former grand design houses up for sale, as well as you've been looking at building your own, because new builds, well, they haven't actually come up to scratch in a lot of cases. Firstly, grand designs. What's going on here?
Well, who hasn't watched Grand Designs and thought, I'd quite like to live in a house like that? I mean, who hasn't watched Grand Designs and thought, God, I wouldn't want to live in that house? But there are many houses there that look quite spectacular. And of course, these houses, once they're built and people have lived in them, they do eventually come up for sale. And Myra Butterworth, our property reporter, spotted three that were. Mm-hmm. So we have a castle in Yorkshire. We have the Roundhouse, which is a very interesting house, which is basically a donut. It's a round house with a hole in the middle, a terrace in the middle. And the final one that we have here is this one with amazing panoramic views across the South Wales countryside, which, you know, you literally look like you're sat on top of the world.
Why are they selling?
I guess... Who knows?
They're good for commuting, aren't they? They're all in the middle of nowhere.
And that is the problem with building your own home, isn't it? Is that it's very difficult to find the land anywhere near, anywhere in, well, I was going to say civilization. I won't say that. But yeah, it's difficult to find somewhere near to places that are convenient. But I guess, you know, they're selling because various reasons why they want to move. Why do people want to move? But there is the prospect that these people, having built their own homes, might make a sizable profit.
I don't doubt they will indeed. But if you are not looking for a buy-to-let, a place in the sun or a grand design, you just want a normal house to live in, we're inclusive here on Share Radio, you've not been forgotten about. But the question is, do you go for an existing home or a new build? Many benefits to be had. No damp, no hidden damage perhaps from the previous tenant. Built to modern standards, and you can decorate it as you will. But This Is Money have highlighted the case of one man. James Haywood from Yorkshire just got engaged. Brand new five-bedroom family home. Things looking very rosy for James until he got the keys. So, Rich, tell us a little bit more about this case, and then Simon, I'll get your views about new builds more generally, as you've been specifically looking into this. Tell us about poor old James from Yorkshire.
Well, poor old James, unfortunately, isn't alone. There's so many of these stories around now where these places are just put up so quickly, and the walls move, the floors. I think James had creaky floors, which... doesn't sound like a big deal, but
taking a look at the pictures, James seemed to have everything going wrong on this one.
There were holes in the plasterwork, paint was missing from some of the walls, the boiler was hanging off, alarming bulges protruded from the gables, and there were dents in the garage door, which basically sounds like someone has trashed a house, mm-hmm. not like you've just bought a brand new house off a developer. And then it's taken him ages to try and get this sorted. Like, literally ages.
Years.
I think we're talking 5 years. 5 years on. And both now aged 35, James and wife Liz, are still fighting for a finished home. The developer, David Wilson Homes, which is an upmarket brand owned by Barratt, has apologised and promised to fix the problems. But it's the, you know, what for many people is meant to be a snagging process, which is when you go around your new home and you identify the problems and then the developer comes around and fixes them. Within a couple of months, has stretched on and on and on and on. And there have been some very, very unfavourable comments in the reader comments section from people about new build homes and the quality of new build homes in the UK.
Isn't it the case where they desperately try and finish it before the end of their financial year, and then
yes.
that's when the problems
the timing
really
is important as well, indeed.
Yeah, this was what was suggested. And also what was suggested is that this is a problem where we're desperately trying to encourage developers to put up more homes and to do it faster, and they literally can't keep up. And so standards are slipping. Plus, you've got a lot of older workers, more experienced workers from the building trade who dropped out of the building trade when everything crashed post-2008, you know, 2007, 2008, and they haven't re-entered the market. And also, there's another interesting stat, and I'm going to say this, but I think... basically, it's something like only 30% of new homes are now built by small developers, or it might be even less. Mm-hmm. And there's this issue where it's the big developers, you know, building en masse rather than small local developers. And there's a suggestion that when you're buying the average home, you're getting a lower quality than you would do with a smaller local developer that puts the effort in. I don't know whether that really stands up to scrutiny, but that is one suggestion. And I think that what this illustrates is that there's this huge gap with new homes between the average home and the top end of the market. And if you buy a new build home and you buy a fancy £1 million, you know, £2 million new build home, you get massive rooms, you get a bathroom for every bedroom, you get everything done to the highest spec. If you buy an average new build home, yeah. the complaint is you get rooms that are too small, plots that are too small, and things that aren't built quite as well as they could be.
Well, you've been looking at this. A detailed REBA report in 2011 showed three-bedroom family homes sold by our eight largest house builders were on average 8 metres squared smaller than the recommended minimum. New homes in the UK are the smallest in Western Europe. Now, the concern, if we're worried about the fact that this housing crisis and the government is under pressure to build more, the average time it takes, you note here, to build a new house has jumped from 24 to 32 weeks, but the government is desperate to slash that. Only in February, the Housing Minister, Brandon Lewis, blasted developers' efforts as not good enough, claiming they should be able to build a house in 3 to 4 weeks. Your thoughts, Rich?
I think when the government starts shouting at you to get a move on, the contrarian nature of the British builder is going to take that and probably try and do the complete opposite. You know, to do things properly, it takes time, and we should respect that. I know there's about 100,000 homes shortfall. I think the target's 250,000 a year, and they're building about 150,000. Mm-hmm. So something perhaps needs to be done, but doing things quicker. We moved house about 6 months ago, and we looked at some new builds, and they were smallish local builders, and the quality was okay. But they were coming on, there was a big new estate, and they were coming on really, really slowly. And of course, they were small. Once you get inside, surface area was in a detached house was about the same as the end of terrace that we were moving out of.
So, Simon, you said you'd definitely like to build your own. Tell us more.
I would, yeah. I asked the question, would you buy a new build home? And readers resolutely came on the side of no. And like me, I think their main concern is basically over the size. It's not, you know, the quality thing obviously is a big issue, but I think it is a concern over the size of these properties. And I looked at this REBA report, which showed that Britain's new homes just aren't big enough. And actually, funnily enough, new homes in London are bigger. So they're bigger than everywhere else. And this is completely the opposite way round to what you would think it would be, isn't it? But it's because London has minimum space standards. And the government has introduced minimum space standards. But apparently, basically, these are very difficult for local authorities to actually implement, and developers can wriggle out of them. So what's the answer to this? Well, the question, would you buy a new build home, when I answered it in a poll, no, said 70% of people, and yes, said 30%. So my suggestion is build it yourself. I'd like it to be easier to build your own home. And it doesn't have to be a massive grand design style project. We're talking about things that are relatively simple to do. And they do this across the whole of Europe. If you go to France in particular, they'll identify a patch of land. They'll then make the individual plots available for people to buy with the services ready to go in. So, you know, the utilities, the electricity, the gas, the water and so on, which solves a big problem. Then you design your own home. And you get it built, and it's relatively simple. They do tend to be a variation on a theme, but you get to specify what goes where, how big the rooms are. And I bet you could guarantee that if more people built their own home in the UK, the new homes that were being built wouldn't be so small. And the other point I'd make is that I think if we are going to eat into the green belt, then maybe we should make it a priority to make these patches of land available for people and try and, you know, work from the bottom up there.
Editor Simon Lambert, Development Editor Rich Browning from This Is Money.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
And let's turn our attention to scams, shall we? They come in all shapes and sizes and are getting harder to spot. Here's some of our experiences at Share Radio.
She was a TalkTalk customer and she had a call from a very plausible individual saying they were from the company. But because of the theft of customer data, they wanted to go through her setup with her and just make some changes. And she said they were so believable, it didn't even enter her head that there was anything wrong. And she was just about to maybe divulge details or whatever when her son, who was passing through the room, said, "Mum, that looks a bit dodgy." And so he stopped her in the nick of time.
I was out coming home late one night and someone approached me and asked me to give them some money because they had missed the last train home. And they gave me a handbag as security, said they'd come back the next day and pay me back. And they disappeared off into the night and they never came back and I didn't see my money ever again. It took me a whole day to open it because I felt terrible doing it. It just had a hairbrush and nothing else.
About 5 years ago, I sent off some pills for a trial. They're slimming pills, actually. And the scam was that the moment that you received the pills, whether you tried them or liked them or not, you were immediately roped into a lifelong subscription, which would cost hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And you couldn't get out of it because the bank said it's not for the bank to unwind this standing order. So only by shouting down the phone at them was I able to get out of it.
Did the pills work?
And we're meant to be financial experts. But there is one fraud we're being particularly warned to be on the lookout for at the moment, following a huge rise in the US: cash machines. Now, we know we aren't meant to use them if they've been tampered with, but how can you tell? And it really isn't as easy as you might think. Up to 2,500 Brits fall victim at ATMs every single week. That's according to Financial Fraud Action UK. And those heading to the US on business have been told to take extra care, as ATM fraud there has gone up for travellers by 546% in just 1 year. And experts reckon that wave could be heading our way soon. Rich, you've been looking at the telltale signs. What are they?
The trouble with these cash machines is they're all slightly different. So you don't stand a chance if they've been tampered with. I mean, the classic thing is that there's a big unit that's put over the slot that you put your card into that, you know, then reads your card and steals all your details and then ultimately steals all your money. But the some of the cash points I see look like they've got a device on.
Well, that's the thing, like you said, there are different ones. And actually, it's not the bank's ATMs that are the most faked. It's the other ones we're seeing. Isn't that right, Simon?
Yeah, it is, actually. I was warned about this recently. There's a cash machine, one of those just cash machines by a newsagent kind of thing. Not one you had to pay for, because I wouldn't use one you had to pay for. Not that silly. But I was about to get some money from it, and someone said I wouldn't use that cash machine. That cash machine's definitely tampered with. You know, I lost my card, or I then got defrauded after it. Mm. And she said, and it happened to my friend as well. And I thought, that's interesting. So I did go and walk and use another cash machine. So it's quite interesting that local people were saying, oh, yeah, I wouldn't use that one. That one's definitely dodgy. Yeah. But, I mean, you've got the false front that can capture both pins and money. You've got the bulky card slot, which might suggest the skimmer that secretly swipes your card details. You've got the loose or blocked card slot, which might suggest a Lebanese loop that catches your card in the machine and then hides it for the fraudster to take. You've got the loose pin pad, maybe a fake overlay to read your pin as you type. And then you've got the old-fashioned loitering stranger who may be attempting to read your pin over your shoulder or even carry out a distraction robbery.
What was interesting to me is a Mail Online reporter, no less, became the victim of a scam when they were caught on film. A little camera was in the ATM machine and it went straight to their mobile phone. Go to This Is Money, because it describes it a lot better than I can. But also, you've been looking at skimming. There's a product out there, apparently, to protect people from skimming. 100% guaranteed, no less. I'm always a bit dubious about anything that claims to be 100%. What are we talking about here? Defender Note.
This is this funny little thing that you basically put a wallet-sized shielding card. You put it in your wallet and it stops people scamming your contactless debit card. So that sort of conspiracy theory worry that people have of someone walking down the tube or the bus with a contactless card reader just going beep, 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 taking money off you, it stops people doing that. And it's being sold for £5.95, and it claims to be able to stop this. And this will mean that people no longer have to do things like We've heard stories of people wrapping their wallet in tinfoil and various other things like that.
Cheaper than £5.95, I might suggest. But also, what they're saying is that you probably need one for both sides, you see. So it's going to be more expensive.
There you go.
I've written one word across the top of this article. Simon, what does it say?
It says, buy now. No, it says paranoid.
I had to double check that.
Georgie has written paranoid.
I've written paranoid. We could go bananas about these things, couldn't we?
We could go bananas about these things. And I must admit that I'm actually a big fan of contactless cards. Mm. I like the fact that I don't have to put it into the machine and put my pin in. I love the fact that I can use it on the tube. Although I have heard other people comment and say, well, that's great. So basically that 2 seconds you're saving yourself from putting your pin in, you'll love that when you get defrauded, won't you? So who knows?
I think we're trying to fix a problem here that isn't a problem, isn't it? I mean, the number of cases of people having their handbags scanned in the co-op is is not worth £5.95 of anybody's money, I don't think.
No, exactly. Well, we're gonna change our tack a little bit now. Coming up, Highway to Hell, AC/DC replacing Brian Johnson with Axl Rose. Can you get a refund? But first, sticking with highways, we're going to focus on cars a little bit more. Peugeot 205 GTI selling for a whopping £25,000 at auction. But first, I want to just have a reminder, shall we? The emissions scandal has reared its ugly head again this week. It's the turn of Mitsubishi following in the footsteps of VW, who are moving to try and put an end to the whole sorry saga. So just very briefly, Simon, keep us up to speed with this. Mitsubishi, VW, where are we at?
Well, Mitsubishi was found out to have been falsifying its fuel economy figures, and it was shopped by fellow car maker Nissan, which had also been selling some of the cars itself in a joint venture with Mitsubishi. And Nissan, in its own tests, discovered that Mitsubishi had been telling porky pies, and so grassed them up and grassed itself up in the process, but said, look, we didn't know about this. These cars were only really sold in Japan, to be honest. They're a thing called K cars. They're funny little blocky looking cars that people drive. So it's mainly, you know, affected Asia, but obviously Mitsubishi is a global car maker, and so it just leads a little bit more into that whole distrust of the car making industry that we have after the emissions scandal.
Yeah, absolutely. And VW as well. Anyone might be saying, okay, well, Mitsubishi, that's Japan, VW, that's the US, but I'm just reading here, diesel cars producing many times more health damaging pollutants than claimed by laboratory tests, with some emitting up to 12 times the EU maximum when tested on the road. That's according to a government study undertaking following the Volkswagen scandal. The study from the Department for Transport of cars made by manufacturers such as Ford, Renault, Vauxhall found a vast difference in the amount of nitrogen oxide emitted when the laboratory results and normal driving were compared. Well, earlier we spoke to James Batchelor, editor-at-large at Auto Magazine.
We've always had fears that there was a discrepancy between what manufacturers were publishing and what real-world emissions tests were producing. But this news is quite surprising because it shows how widespread this problem is. It appears that no new car currently on sale at the moment is meeting these strict NOx emissions regulations, which in itself is very surprising.
Now, of course, this is a blow for the industry, which says, this is the SMMT, the main trade body, says it's assessing the results from the test. What do you think the implications of this are for car makers?
Well, it finally confirms that there have been some big discrepancies. The SMT have come out and said that there needs to be real-world testing of these cars. Obviously, the SMT is defending car manufacturers. They're saying that the test isn't up to standard. It needs to be changed. And they're trying to campaign for it to be changed. When this will happen, we really don't know.
We do not know. And I imagine that will roll on for some time. That was James Batchelor, editor-at-large at Auto Magazine, speaking to Morning Money's Nigel Cassidy here on Share Radio. But let's turn to a positive car story, Simon, for one particular seller anyway, £25,000. For a Peugeot 205 GTI.
Well, this caught my interest because I have a vested interest here. I am also the owner of a Peugeot 205 GTI, which is, I should add, not a £25,000 car. My car would cost me less than £5,000. It's gone up in value since I bought it a year and a half ago. It's probably worth about £6,000 now. And basically, the 205 GTI has become a classic car. I mean, they're 25 years old now, and they were remembered as one of the great hot hatches, along with the VW Golf GTI, the Renault 5 GT Turbo.
Why,
and the
Simon?
Much rarer Lancia Delta Integrale.
Why, Simon? They're not particularly pretty, are they?
I think they're a nice-looking little car, but they're not a classic sports car. But because they are immense fun to drive, they handle very well. They're not fast by modern standards. If you put them in a straight-line drag race with a modern-day hot hatch, they'd come out, you know, a very much a distant second. But they are wonderful fun to drive, and people love them. And what this is the story of a car that was once commonplace on the UK's roads, and then you see this arc, and there's this classic arc of, like, you get a car that everyone loved, then it loses its value. Many of them fall into disrepair. They get scrapped. There's still the enthusiasts out there who love them, but then the interest starts to pick back up. And this one has sold for £25,000, which is a record. That's a huge amount of money. You know, the ones that are considered to be going for high prices at the moment are on sale for £10,000. This is more than double that. But this has been completely restored to the point where they reckon it's basically as good as it would have come out the factory. And in fact, actually, the comment has been it's probably better than it would have come out the factory. But I wrote about this because of the auction result, but also because of this whole story of a classic car, of how this works. You know, you get this arc of interest, and I think it's really interesting when you see these things start to emerge. And the other thing we've seen this emerge with recently is Capris, Ford Capris, which were once the butt of many jokes and are now selling for huge sums of money. And in fact, one sold for a record sum again this week, £55,000, wow. Albeit it was one that was in the professionals.
Ridiculous amount of money. Simon, finally, from one highway to another. An email to This Is Money raised a rather interesting point this week. I bought tickets to see AC/DC. This is not me. This is JW, who's rather unhappy. For both their UK concerts, and now they've changed their lead singer to Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose. Am I entitled to a refund on the basis that I bought the tickets to see Brian Johnson as frontman and not someone else? And it turns out it's not just JW who is unhappy. It might be because AC/DC sound like this. They don't, but they might do. So tell me, can you get a refund because they switched the frontman? We should bear in mind as well, this is not the original AC/DC lineup. Guitarist Malcolm Young had to leave the group due to dementia. Drummer Phil Rudd had serious legal issues that legally prevent him from leaving New Zealand. And now Brian Johnson has hearing problems, making that touring impossible. So this is not the original lineup, but can you get your money back?
No.
Okay.
This is a genuine reader email, arrived on Monday morning to much amusement from us, myself and Richard and Lee. And Lee went off and actually answered the question. Good on him. And he said that basically, because effectively what they've done is they're going ahead with the gigs and they've got a stand-in, you cannot normally get your money back just because someone's got a stand-in, okay? Because they've gone out and got a stand-in. If they hadn't got anyone, then maybe you could argue it. And also, the argument is they've got a stand-in of similar standard. So it's not like they've just gone out and got some bloke off the street. They've gone out and got, basically, one of rock's most famous singers. Mm-hmm. So they've got Axl Rose. There were some comments from people saying you should be paying more. But there were also many more comments from AC/DC fans who've said, you know, Brian Johnson is an integral part of this AC/DC gig that I wanted to go to and I've got tickets to, and Axl Rose is not the person I want to see. So you can understand their anger, but the answer as it stands is no, you can't get a refund.
Sorry about that. Editor Simon Lambert, Development Editor Rich Browning.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.